Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did a boy born into poverty in Ethiopia grow up to make his name as the chef of Manhattan's most celebrated Nordic restaurant and later as the owner of a restaurant and food media company with properties from Stockholm to Southern California? Marcus Samuelson's Stranger Than Fiction life story has taken him all over the globe, hungry in each time and place to learn as much as he could about the flavors and cultures and techniques, the better to refine and share them with patrons at the many kitchens in which he has worked. He shares his life story in his new book, Yes, Chef, a memoir. He's in town for a sold-out event tonight at the Central Market Store in Dallas. Marcus, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me, Chris. Happy to be here.
So you open this book with a really gripping account of your young family in a desperate situation. It is your birth mother, your sister, and yourself in the throes of tuberculosis during an outbreak in Ethiopia.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was important to connect with the reader about where it all started, right? It started in the savannah of Africa, where red clay comes up to your face and there are tons of flies, I come from this clay hut, the classic clay hut in Africa. And I also wanted to show, even if you don't have money, you can have a lot of dignity and do incredible things. And for me, I'm here because my mother saved me and my sister's life. She was about 28 years old, slim woman, walked 75 miles with two kids, found a hospital in the capital, which, I mean, even finding a hospital in the capital of Ethiopia, the hospitals, there's a line out the door, so it takes days to come in. Mm-hmm. She got us into the hospital, and eventually she passed away and we survived. And the other thing that I think is fascinating is that so many, you know, random things of luck. You know, the nurse that was at that hospital, a regular woman, already having four kids of her own, said, you know, we're going to take these two kids in. I'm going to take these two kids in, and I'm going to set them up for adoption to a Swedish family. You know, there's a lot of thousands of kids in the hospital for her to save me and my sister for a second time, essentially, because even if we were cured from TB, where would we go? We had nowhere to go.
And later on, you discovered that the woman who would become your mother actually stayed in contact with that nurse for years and years.
Mm-hmm. My mother, Anne-Marie, my Swedish mother, Anne-Marie, amazing woman, always pushed through things and always make sure that we were in contact with Ethiopia. Although, when we were kids, we just wanted to be Swedish kids, you know. Yeah. We didn't want to go to one when my mom wanted to take us to like an African night or a Ethiopian, you know, meeting other Ethiopian kids. We were more like, we just want to be Swedish kids. Mm-hmm. It wasn't really until I came to the States where I started to see Ethiopian culture and people started to respond to me more as an Ethiopian man. I started to sort of find out more about myself and wanted to learn more about myself. And eventually, I went to Ethiopia.
Yeah, we're getting ahead of the book here, but we'll come back to all of this. But you write about being in Ethiopia for the first time and seeing people for the first time in your life, lots of people who looked very much like you physically. Mm-hmm. But you could see the 9-year-old version of yourself selling something on the street or walking to school or an adult, you know, an elderly version. What, can you talk about that?
Well, I mean, going to Ethiopia for me, it was such a strong experience, right? I look 100% Ethiopian, yet I didn't have the language. And I also didn't just have enough about the culture. I was there to learn that, to absorb all that. And, you know, so you felt like I belonged, but yet maybe I didn't belong. So it was strange, but I knew that I had to sort of put myself in front of that and take what I could sort of understand. The smell of food became something that I related to, the berbere, the spice blend that I actually put on the cover of the book, Yes, Chef, become something that the music that I could have, I've heard similar music, I heard Ethiopian music in New York. I've had these dishes in Washington, D.C., where the Ethiopian community is great. So, you know, quickly I put myself into things that I was comfortable with. You know, I played soccer with kids. You know, I did things that, because I had to learn about it. And I didn't learn everything the first time. I went back in again and again and again. And eventually I met my birth father and my sisters and brothers. But, you know, I also don't think that I could have done all that without my Swedish upbringing and my parents always being in front of me, next to me, and behind me.
I think your story is so interesting because your parents really didn't care about the fact that you and your sisters were Black. They wanted kids. They wanted to raise a family. But there comes that point in everyone's life, particularly people who are adopted by parents of any different race, when they realize, oh, I'm not exactly like everybody else around me. And you describe this moment where you had to ask yourself, okay, I'm not like anyone else. Am I really so different?
I think, first of all, any family is going to have challenging times,
yeah.
right? And I think it's important to remember that. And my mom was the first one to say that, you know, when you're 13, 14 years old, life is just awkward for a long time. And some kids, and the good thing when you go to school, all kids experience it. In an adopted household, you experience this as well. So it's important then not just to say, oh, is it different just because you're adopted?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I think also the fact that we were a different race helped us because quickly, was it known, of course, that we weren't from, you know, these were not my biological parents, right? It was nothing to hide. There was no one ever that was confused about it.
Right.
You know, that me and my sister and my other sister had these white parents and that we had Korean cousins, that we had a Jewish aunt. You know, we were a mixed family. And that was the Samuelsons. But again, I think that the fact that I knew every day I went to school, I knew that my parents loved me. I knew that they were very strict, but they were always behind me and supported me. And that is the biggest story of Yes Chef that I want to sort of convey, that I'm here because I had strong family roots, just not only with my direct family, but also with my grandparents. And otherwise, I wouldn't be able to be the chef I am today and continue in the sort of my search of my craft that I love so much.
When you tried to identify your very first food memory, what came to your head was the smell of your grandmother's kitchen. What did it smell like?
Well, my grandma Helga, she had like a little food factory at home. And I always feel like I'm lucky because I'm old enough and young enough. And I mean that with a sense of that she was a maid and became a cook and come from a very poor background, but she ate well.
Mm-hmm.
So the food pantry was important. She didn't really trust the refrigerator, absolutely not the freezer, because those were those old freezers where, you know, if you try to pull something out, it could sort of leak for 2 days
right.
and stuff like that. But the pantry she trusted. So we constantly run up and down between her kitchen and her pantry, and we did stuff. It was roasted chicken one day. It was chicken soup the next day. Chicken dumpling the third day.
So you're stretching that chicken
stretching
so it's good.
It. Yeah. But every meal was just as good.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, we had to take up the carrots, and then we had to pickle some carrots. And we ate farm to table before that term even existed. You know, summertime when we went to the summer house, you ate fish. It's like you don't go into a Dallas barbecue joint here and ask for, you know, what fish are you going to barbecue for me? You eat meat.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing on the coast of Sweden. You eat fish. You can smoke it. You can pickle it. You can preserve it. But you eat fish. So we were constantly around food. My grandma's kitchen smelled so much of pickling and preserving, that's a smell, that vinegar.
Mm-hmm.
Spices like ginger snaps, warm bread in the morning. You know, it can have apples, plums, but then she made apple jam and we had to jar it. And then it was, you know, it was really about taking care of the seasons and eating well with a very sort of controlled economy, which then, of course, helped me when I became an executive chef because I knew what to do with the leftovers.
Yeah, exactly. And that's part of the success or failure of a restaurant is being mm-hmm. able to handle the financial part of it.
No, absolutely. I mean, we have, as executive chefs, we have a huge responsibility. You know, we throw away in America 33% of our food. We have a huge food chasm in this country. 10 million kids goes to bed hungry every day in the richest country in the world. If we learn how to cook and eat with a spiritual compass, if we learn how to take care of our leftovers better, we would have answers to that. You know, there were real answers. And I think that I was taught that by my grandmother at the beginning of that. I think about that as an executive chef cooking in Harlem. And, you know, if I have a huge platform, well, part of my job is to educate about that. That's what we do on our website.
You write about an early experience on a fishing trip with your dad, and you mm-hmm. were put in charge of kind of pan frying what you guys had caught. And you conclude at the end of that day that if the food is fresh and it's made with love, then the meal is going to be satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious about that question of love. Does that mean love for the ingredients? Does it mean love for who you're cooking for? Can that extend to the strangers you cook for in your restaurant?
Oh, all of the above. I definitely think respect and love for the ingredients. And, you know, when you work in a fisherman environment, you truly have that. You don't waste anything in the water. Mm-hmm. If the fish is not big enough, you put it back. You know, there's a certain rules. There's a code of ethic.
Yeah.
When if we had 25 mackerels every morning, you know, we put 5 aside to pickle and preserve. We took 5 that we gave to our elderly neighbors. We maybe took 5 or 10 that we smoked. The rest we cooked. It was never about, oh, we have 20 mackerels for ourselves. Never. Mm-hmm. It's really about thinking ahead, thinking about our neighbors, and what are we going to eat today? So that sense of love came into it too. And then, of course, the meal itself, that the product is the highlight. The fish is the highlight. So we sear it very simple. I went outside to pick some fresh chives, wild chives, mm-hmm. boiled potatoes that we have right there, squeeze some lemon, and that was the meal. So it was within, it was organic. It was of the season, and it was cooked with love and understanding. Right, and of course, serving your uncle or serving your dad then was for me the highest honor, because those were the people that I wanted to cook for and impress by. And when you cook in a restaurant, it's the same thing. You want to connect with your diners, whether they're the visitors or the Harlemite or the New Yorkers or wherever you are, right? But I always say to my staff, people don't have time. If they've taken time out to come and see us, we have to over-deliver. And that intention to serve has to come through in our eyes, first of all. The best restaurant in the world is where you get eye contact right away. Even if they're going to deliver you, hey, it's going to be 25 minutes for the table. But if they see you and they see that you took time out to come here, you're going to be fine with that answer.
Yeah.
But if you just heads down, nothing. So it's very important to connect with the diner.
Something that comes out in this book that I think the average restaurant patron maybe takes for granted is how dangerous it is in the back of the house at pretty much every restaurant. You can never let your guard down.
What I want to explain in this era where is, you know, cooking is becoming so popular, which I'm so privileged and happy, excited about, that we get more students into the field. But I also want to explain, both for the diner, the reader, but also for the young cook, that this is a craft, and you have to be on your toes. You have to be on your guard. I don't know any other field where you can get hot oil on your hand and you can ruin your best weapons, really, the first day of work. Somebody will slip with a big knife. So you, as a chef, you constantly worry about the guys on the lowest on the totem pole, not your top cooks. Because they've been around, they know how to walk. It's a walk, it's a mood, it's a look. You sense it. Mm-hmm. You always worry about the one that quite not sure if they're going to be in the kitchen or not.
Yeah.
That is dangerous element right there. Because it's a hot steamer, it's a pressure cooker, it is hot oil, it's a knife. It's a lot of different things that's coming in. And you got to be on your game.
My guest is author and chef Marcus Samuelson. His new book is called Yes, Chef, A Memoir. He's in town for an event at the Central Market Store in Dallas this evening, but it is already sold out, so we are very glad we have him here on the show with us. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in now to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author, chef, and restaurant owner Marcus Samuelson. His new book is called Yes, Chef, a Memoir. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. So, Marcus, I want to talk about your evolution as a chef and your training in a minute. But before that time came, you had a different dream, and it was important enough to you that you devote a pretty significant amount of time writing about your dream of being an athlete.
Yeah, because I think there's a link there, and I learned a lot by I wanted to become a soccer star, and I did pretty well in soccer. But what it taught me more than anything was rejection and how to deal with rejection, which we all, as adult kids, have to deal with. And also it taught me about teamwork, team effort, and work ethic. And that was installed by my parents, but it was even more pronounced by my coach, right? And what is a kitchen? It's a brigade. Coach could be chef. In the kitchen and on a soccer team, you have this, you have to be a good teammate. Same thing in the kitchen. You develop this sort of us against the world type of mentality, which you have in the kitchen too. And as a young kid, you just want to belong to something. Mm-hmm. You know, you're searching. You know, you have those two, three different places. Right? You have your home, you have school, and then you have that third place, which is could be sports for me or could be kitchen. So I just took that rejection really, really hard. But it was also a sign of that I was other, that I didn't necessarily fit in to that model, which, you know, you can, many people can relate to, most people can relate to. We've all been part of rejection as professionals or in dating or whatever it is, right? It's part of life, but it's really about how do you dust yourself off and move forward and take the positive out of that experience. And I am so grateful to be a chef and the chef I would like to be in the search I'm trying to become still to this day. Because the lessons also I learned in soccer, because I loved it so much and I love cooking so much. So I know that you can get easily voted off this island, easily. All creative works are very, it's a thin line, right? Yeah. And I'm privileged that 20 years later I have a dialogue with the public in the country that I choose to come. So I'm extremely grateful to Americans and being an immigrant and now being American. But it was a lot that I learned there on the soccer pitch.
Did that prepare you to get screamed at when you made a mistake? Because there was sure a lot of that in your early in your early career.
Well, you know, it's a humble journey being a chef. And you start from being like a commis to a demi-chef de partie to a chef de partie to, a, you know, to a line cook and sous chef and eventually a chef. And I also want, again, this book, Yes, Chef, is for me the book that it wasn't, when I was coming up, there wasn't a book for me that sort of gave me, there was a book like that out there that I could sort of give me hope and I can understand to and hold on to. But I also want to show that it's a humble journey. Mm-hmm. And I probably be yelled at every language there is, right? At least French, German, Swedish, English. And it's okay as long as you learn something. You know, I learned that it was okay. You know, sometimes it was harder than others. But I didn't care if France in Switzerland yelled at me as long as he taught me how to debone that lamb. Mm-hmm. I didn't care if, you know, Joseph in France screamed with me. If he taught me how to clean foie gras faster than the next one, I'm good. That's fair trading to me. So, you know, I don't have tattoos, but I feel like I have classic craft marks in my face, on my arms, in my stomach. Those are all crafts from, you know, marks from the love letters from the trade, you know. Here is seared scallop, circa 1991, you know. And, you know, every mark I have on me, it's from food. But it didn't mean that I was upset about the guy that did that to me. It means that maybe I was young and didn't make a mistake. And the answer back was, yes, chef.
Hmm. Yeah, that's where the title comes from, that your reply, no matter what, had to be, yes, chef.
Yeah.
No arguing back.
No arguing back. And understanding that you were in the wrong right now, here. It's not a Swedish democracy. Right now, in order for this kitchen to move best for the customer, chef needed everybody to be on the same page. Mm-hmm. So the answer is yes, chef. Afterwards, we might or might not discuss it. Mm-hmm. And it's actually not my call. It's his call or her call.
Yeah.
And that's a humbling lesson that sometimes it's needed. And it helped me to stay in shape, stay focused. And slowly start also allowing me to ask questions, right? why is all the food that we were taught just French? But why I started to love Mexican street food. I love the food from Singapore. Started to develop my own taste bud. Started to ask myself questions such as, will I be the guy that just going to execute someone else's food? Mm-hmm. Can I start to develop recipes that people would like?
It's really interesting to read in the book, as you develop your skills, as you develop your palate, you do start to have these questions about why, particularly in Europe, French cuisine is considered the gold standard, even though there are all these countries that have these rustic traditions of their own.
But not particularly in Europe. Everywhere at that point, you know, you got to dial this back 20, 25 years ago. And we just, I mean, back then, Italian food wasn't even on the map. Mm-hmm. I mean, we, of course, advanced from that. And then eventually the Japanese Revolution and now Spain and then eventually the Scandinavian countries and American food. But back then, it was just French food. And I love French food and I'm so privileged to have gone to France, but it had to be more. And I learned that not from the chefs, but I actually learned it from my cooking colleagues that came from all over the world. These young cooks, when we were off, we cooked for each other. Japanese miso soup, you know, Singaporean fried rice, Indian breakfast, learned the difference between ginger and galanga, lemongrass, and so on. So this vocabulary, my vocabulary started to become of the world. And I was like, I got to go.
So when you first really started training seriously, you were very passionate, very dedicated, but you were nervous. I mean, you write about the fact that you would throw up before every shift or during every shift, just from nerves at first. What made it so so full of anxiety for
you? Well, first I wanted to also share with the reader that at every level you are, there's been a journey here and you've gone through stuff. And for me, throwing up every day, but it's also how you overcome that. I knew every day that I would throw up. Mm-hmm. I had a routine down. I knew how to take off my apron, leave my station, walk fast, not run, because somebody's seen me running, go to the bathroom, throw up in the cleaner bathroom, wash myself, run back to the kitchen, and keep chopping carrots like nobody's business.
Right.
Like this. Mm-hmm. And this happens in families today. A lot of people, you know, kids go to school and they have, you know, there's little things and they come back and then everything looks like it's normal, mm-hmm. right? And so we just all share in these experiences of being nervous. And obviously, once I started to understand the language in Switzerland, once I felt that I wouldn't be fired just because I made one mistake, I stopped throwing up. I stopped being nervous. So it was about not being comfortable as being lazy, but comfortable enough that I had arrived, that I belonged. That was the answer that I needed to not doing that. And for each person is different, right? But that was one. You know, I'm a Swedish kid, you know, menus in French, people speak German. If they know you speak German, they go back to French quickly so you don't understand. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are like mean, mostly boys, you know. The oldest guy is 26, you know, it's really old, right? So you're trying to set yourself up for failure and you got to outsmart that mm-hmm. the whole time. But it's also a test of desire, what you want, passion, commitment.
What did it feel like as you moved along through your career to realize that in certain cases, perhaps many cases, you were sort of bypassing the people who had taught you important things and, mm-hmm. and then you were moving beyond them in terms of your ability and your desire?
As the youngest kid in the kitchen, it happened several times, but I realized also that they travel with me. My tribe of young chefs that I came up with, they were a little bit older than me, still write to me today and still are in contact with me today. And they know where they are. They're all over the world, actually. And they travel with me. And through Facebook or through email or through different ways, we stay connected. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't be here without them, without that chef that opened up the door and said, hey, you can go to Switzerland. Or without that guy saying, hey, I'm going to send you to France.
Let's explain that, because you describe what sounds to an American audience almost like the sort of farm team system for baseball. It's mm-hmm. you go from minor league to major league and people sort of move you around and you get traded with or without perhaps your consent.
No, I mean, and the first time I got sent away somewhere was to Amsterdam and I was super excited, but my father didn't allow me to go.
Too many drugs was his concern?
Yeah, he was, you know, he just didn't know about the feel of cooking. He knew about France and Switzerland in terms of cooking, but he just didn't know about Amsterdam. So he's like, you can't go. And I had to go back the next day to chef and say, I'm not going. And it was completely embarrassing for me. But it was also, he was in charge still, but he wanted the best for me. And 6 months later, I got the job in Switzerland. And, you know, and then eventually I always wanted to go to France. And one of my most successful moments in my entire life is the day when I get the job in a 3-star Michelin restaurant in France. And that gives me the allowance to work for free for a year.
Talk about your arrival in the U.S. and how you went about finding work and finding just a collection of people who would be your friends.
Mm. Well, I came. It was clear to me that I needed to move to the States. Wherever I went, I was the only person of color. I mean, even existing the fact that it was a black chef in the kitchen, that they've never even seen the concept. And when they realized that I just was like the other young 21, 22-year-olds, just wanted to learn, and I wasn't the dangerous and nothing would happen, and I just wanted the same as them.
Like dangerous, like
they No, but they just didn't know the concept of a black person working in as a chef. Huh. They just never, ever, ever in the history seen it. So once we overcame that, which took a while, I just realized I have to, because my aspiration then was clearly that I'm going to be a chef. And eventually one day own my own place. But you couldn't do it in an environment in Europe back then where there were no other people of color that owned businesses or were managers. So I knew that, okay, it's okay if I'm the only black chef, but I can't do an environment when there's not a Korean doctor mm-hmm. or a Indian lawyer or a Jewish store owner or, you know, with the narrative of people of color being all kinds of color, but owning businesses, not just working in businesses.
Right.
So I had to, and it's funny, when I thought America was the most diverse place to go in New York City, was right post Rodney King.
Mm-hmm.
Right in the middle of Bensonhurst, you know what happened in Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, it was also watching Dinkins becoming a mayor.
Yeah.
Because it was the first time when I saw it, not just in the States, somebody that was not an athlete, was not a singer, that, you know, to be a mayor, you had to be a lawyer, you had to be within the, you know, to be the working tribe for a long time. And that was fascinating to me. So I was like, that's it. I got to go to New York.
You offer in the book some analysis as to why there remain relatively few black chefs in this country, one of which is that you feel like upwardly mobile black parents say to their kids, I did not put you through school so that you could, as you say in the book, flip burgers.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very complex issue, and it's a program by itself. But I do think as a leading black chef, I have to ask questions and I have to start a conversation, a dialogue about this, and race is very challenging and difficult to talk about, but we can talk about it without polarizing each other. We should talk about it. And there are numerous layers, right? One is that, you know, first generation of African Americans being able to go to send their kids to college, they wanted to be just professionals, lawyers, doctors, working within finance, so better, you know, hopefully betting on better financial opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
Well, cooking back then wasn't even a profession. Cooking became a profession in this country in 1977. So people have been cooking forever, but as a profession, it's pretty young. Second is, it was very tough for African Americans to get loan, access to money. You don't need a lot of money to open a restaurant, maybe, small restaurant, but you need access to cash. And truth is, it was easier for immigrants to get loan from the banks than it was to African Americans. And I don't know any other country that has sort of made it easier for the income for the immigrants than for your own people. And that's a fact. That's something that should just be, you know, acknowledged. We moved on from there. But there is numerous layers and access to capital. Other is integration, segregation. You know, not to ever suggest that we should go back. But back in the days when there were complete black neighborhoods, every hotel and or motel or restaurant in that own community was black owned.
Yeah. That's an interesting point.
And then when you remove that structure and you have chains coming in, then that small mom and pop can't survive anymore.
Right.
And also the stigma of slavery and being the serving tribe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you come in as an immigrant, you just want a job. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And then you're better than your kids will go to the next level. But there has been a stigma of obviously being the serving tribe. So much of my work is honoring the African-American chefs that have been here before me, the Leah Chase of the world, sort of the Edna Lewis and the writers such as Jessica Harris. But it's also acknowledging, hey, if America's food's going to be at this highest level, we need all kinds to be within the field, not just looking from the fast casual or fast food industry, but the fine dining. And if we all want, you know, food in America today is very complex. We all want the smartest thinkers. So we need not just African-Americans, we need all colors and people to be within food, because that's how we're going to realize how we're going to have the best, smartest restaurants, best, smartest solutions from all different levels in terms of schools or in terms of green or in terms of poverty.
The other thing you have to do if you want things to be the best is sometimes step back and say, someone else in this organization can do this better than I can. And you write about a chef that you have mentored who, for a variety of reasons, like sort of got how to do, I think it was chicken, right? Fried chicken, in a way that it didn't work for you.
Well, you know, opening Red Rooster in Harlem, I knew I wanted to have a fried chicken on the menu. But I wanted to have it with some sense of authorship, some sense of, it has to be Red Rooster fried chicken. And I didn't grow up with fried chicken. I grew up with roasted fish chicken, salted chicken, but not fried chicken. And I tried and I tried and I tried. And Michael, one of my cooks at the time, sous chef, eventually executive chef, he's like, Marcus, you're overthinking it. This is how you got to do it. This is how it has to taste. And he knew in his gut, the way I knew about mackerel, he knew about fried chicken. And he showed me. And then we had a starting point. And now we evolved it. So, you know, I started even to, every time I do cooking classes, I always said, hey, shake the person's hand like next to you and say, my fried chicken is better than yours. And I said that because if you're going to open a restaurant in Harlem and going to serve fried chicken, you have to have that sense of confidence to do that. And our fried yardbird is our number one seller. And it's definitely with co-creation of Michael's sort of inability to understand it. That's why it's so good.
My guest is author, chef, and restaurant owner Marcus Samuelson. His new memoir is called Yes, Chef, a Memoir. We will come back to the conversation in a moment. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author, chef, and restaurant owner Marcus Samuelson. His new book is called Yes, Chef, a Memoir. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Marcus, another thing that you are very candid about is your personal life. You somehow avoided getting trapped in the sort of drinking and drugs that a lot of chefs do. You were not particularly wild in terms of dating and all that, but you did, in fact, father a daughter when you were quite young.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it was something that I've dealt, you know, I love my daughter and I love the relationship we have, but it was, it's really through the help of my mother that we've been able to maintain that relationship as strong. And I, you know, my daughter lives in a different country, and I'm just, you know, it's something we see each other, and when we see each other, we have a great time. But I was a kid myself, and I talk about it in the book, and it's something that I wasn't ready at the time to deal with, and I always felt like the dream of becoming a chef was taken away from me when I gained something else. And but again, what I talk about so much in Yes, Chef is we are a family. And I have been helped so many times by my family, even when you do left turn, even when you do something that, okay, this here's the situation, how are you going to deal with it? And because of my sisters and my father and my mother, we've been able to have a great relationship. And it's something I'm really proud of that we were all be able to have. And we now are much richer for it, you know.
It's really interesting that you credit your mother with helping to sort of keep that relationship alive, because even in the years when you only had sporadic contact with your daughter's mother, your mom insisted that you pay every expense that came up and sort of made sure that, that there would be a possibility for you to have a relationship at some point.
Yeah, I mean, she saw, you know, in the book I talk a lot about how my father was sort of the strategic visionary in the family, but my mother in a different way. And this was an instinct that she knew about, and she had experience. Maybe the fact that she couldn't have her own family, but she adopted and she got her family, however unorthodox that I was at the time. So she knew that this was a life decision. This wasn't just a should I work in Switzerland or France decision, which I looked at it maybe at the time one, you know. And it's something that it was a challenge in a family that we turned to something positive. And that I feel like I was so committed not to make this book a victory lap of, and then I won this and then I won this. I want it to become something that you can take. There's a real take here that from our lowest point, you can learn something. And everybody's gone through the ups and downs. And I'm extremely happy to have my daughter and have the relationship that we have. And it's thanks to many people, also the daughter's mother.
I wonder if you have perspective on why people who are completely outside the restaurant industry have such an interest in chef memoirs. We had Gabrielle Hamilton a few months ago. We've spoken with Anthony Bourdain over the years. What do you think it is that, that allows members of the general public to really feel like we connect with chefs?
Well, I think you just had, I don't know how big the trend is. I think with Anthony's book, it's an incredible book. And so with Gabrielle's, but you know, those are really good books. And those books, both for me, was very inspirational that, again, they didn't make them as victory laps. They really make them as they were written in a sense of voice that people can relate to. Wow, did that happen? You know, obviously with Food Network and people getting recipes online, and there's so many ways for us to interact with chefs and cooking today. It's on TV. It's part of pop culture today, which I never thought that cooking would be. But it is. So just as much as we want to know about high-profile lawyers or somebody's created something with computers, you know, it was just this connectivity. But I do think also because chefs make something that we ultimately eat, it's something that every family can relate to. It makes you even more connected to it. There is definitely this, you know, everyone can't come up with the smartest engineer solution, but everyone is eating and everyone is cooking at some point. So I do think there's a lot of connectivity. But you just happened to mention books that were incredible books, and they happened to be chef memoirs. They were first and foremost incredible books.
So we talked earlier about, the idea of simply writing a memoir so that you could inspire young cooks and different people like that. And your memories are very clear and very strong here. You mentioned in the book the fact that people often come up to you and they relate to you based on the fact that you are an adopted child. Mm. And parents who have a child from somewhere else will talk to you. And you had a different response to that than I've seen before, which is that in a certain way, that sort of clouds for you what may or may not be a memory of your actual life. Can you speak about that?
Well, I mean, adoption is such a complex issue, right? There is so many things that could, but I also, at the end of the day, I think it's amazing that we can adopt, that we have those options, and it helps so many families, so many kids. But my journey is my journey, and it worked for me and my sisters, and it might not be the perfect solution for somebody else. So it's very hard for me to sort of give an advice one size fits all, but I want to listen and as much as I can, and I want to give my sort of thoughts on it. But I just remember we talked, it was a lot of transparency in my family. My mom talked to me about the years when she couldn't have a baby, for example, and I felt so bad just listening to her about that. But I was so grateful because if that would have been now with all the technology, maybe she could have had a baby. You know, it's all these things in terms of adoption that is so, you know, we still don't know all the details how we got adopted. You know, there's all the, but if I know, but if I go back and scratch and ask too much, what's the point? I'm adult now. I'm so lucky to work with something that I completely adore. I have a family. It all worked out, right? So I'm very cautious about where I am in this conversation. When I ask my biological father, he's like, he's like, Marcus, you grew up in Europe. You got away. You have the life that you wanted to have. So don't complain. It's his message to me always. And I said, I agree. It's very complex. It's not my biggest thing is one size don't fit all on every solution. It's not the same for every adopted family has their own thing.
And what is good is also bad in some ways and vice versa.
Yes.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Sepsum on the line in Dallas. Hi, Sepsum.
Hi, how are you?
Very well.
Yeah, nice to talk to you. I have a question for him that I came from Ethiopia. My name is Fusum Yonas.
Great.
I need to say Ndamna.
Ndamna.
I'm proud of you. Thank you very much what you're doing. But I have a question for you that if you've been in Ethiopia before, which food do you like and why you like it?
Well, I go to Ethiopia every year, and I love, from my wife's tribe, from Garaga, the Kitwo, this warm tatar, beef tatar or lamb tatar, that is sort of tossed in a spiced butter and eaten with injera bread and a little bit of cottage cheese. I love that. Then that's a dish that I find myself missing all the time. And when I come home, sometimes she makes it for me. It makes me very happy. And I also love dorawat, which is a chicken stew dish that comes from the region where I was born. And it's just a thick, rich, beautiful chicken stew. And I think that Ethiopian food is probably, you know, you think about Ethiopian food, and I think I'm so proud that it's in every major city there is great Ethiopian restaurants. And what a great window in to our culture and great vegetarian food. It's also a great country to learn in terms of eating with a spiritual compass. There's always fasting days. There's always days when you don't eat butter, when you don't eat meat. So it's a great window in for America to also actually look at food from a different perspective.
You write that the first time you went to Ethiopia was more like a whirlwind romance than a homecoming.
Yeah. You know, it was just so much to take in, you know, and where do you put everything? So many images. And there were kids on the street. There were the richest culture in terms of dance and music and clothing to how the market worked to, again, kids that had to wake up 2 o'clock in the morning and walk hours to get water. It was all every day. There was new experiences. Now when I go back, it's a little bit more sort of, I've seen this. I'm aware of it. But always when I bring people with me for the first time, I'm like, if you haven't been to Africa, if you haven't been to Ethiopia, this is what it's going to be. You're going to fall in love. It's going to burn you at some point. It's so many emotions, but it's still the country that I love is the country that I'm from, and I'm proud to say I'm Ethiopian, and I learn from Ethiopia every time I go back.
Do you feel that same pride in Sweden? Because I get this sense that you love the culture in which you were raised, and because your skin is black and you look very Ethiopian, it seems easy for people to leap onto that. And yet there's a big part of you that is a Swedish man.
Well, I love Sweden and everything I got from Sweden. Everything I go back and give back to Sweden. It's just too different. I consider myself lucky to have three windows, right? New York, America. It's one, you know, Sweden is one and Ethiopia is one. And they're so different.
Many people have that exact window, which is cool.
No, but we all have a couple of different windows. If you think about it, I just spoke to a woman that was half Cherokee and half from somewhere else. And so I just think it's important to look at these diverse windows, even within a family is white. There's still diversity within that, whether it's spirituality, they come from the coast. So diversity can exist. It's not a race-based thing. It's because so many other things that are under that, and I think we can hold on to them. And mine are very clear, right? Africa, Scandinavia, and America. And I draw from all three all the time, you know, and I think that that's a luxury that I have, and I can explain to people about these places. I've been to Italy. I've never been to Sweden. It's the same. I think, no, it isn't. But they both in Europe, you know. I can explain, you know, the difference between Ethiopia, that Africa is not one country, for example, right? Start right there. But it's not an arrogant question if you don't know. So we can start there. you know, and that's a luxury. And New York is not dangerous. It's a wonderful place. And Harlem is not dangerous. You know, start right there.
Can you talk about this as sort of a non sequitur, but there's a wonderful section of the book when you're still working at the first restaurant where you sort of mm-hmm. became executive chef in New York, and you are trying to perfect these foie gras mm-hmm. blinis, and the process is so obsessive and so mm-hmm. just the tiniest little thing being changed, and this yeah. is not right. Do you always have to have something like that, a puzzle like that you're working on?
Every chef has dishes that are hers or his masterpieces that they work on, and it defines a chef. It also goes through all the emotions you have to have as a chef: curiosity, discipline, striving for authorship in your craft. If you don't have that, you can still become a chef, but it's a different journey. And it's hard to have a restaurant with your name on if you don't have that, mm-hmm. because that's what it takes. Cooking is not generic. It's actually one of the places where they specifically want to know, hear from you. What's your take on this?
Yeah.
Otherwise, I'm not paying. Otherwise, I'm not coming. Mm-hmm. And it's not, I think that's wonderful. It's a field where it's not about politics, it's not about changing your religion, but actually we want to know your point of view. And then I have to be specific and hone down. And very often, it's in the repetition and in the search for details and finding your own voice.
How did you come to cook at the White House?
Wow, it's long. A lot of trials and a lot of... I got the question. I got asked, I remember, in August of that year. And it were 40 chefs that were asked to come up with a menu. And I knew right away then that that was not about me serving my favorite dishes, maybe. It was really about understanding the role of a servant mm-hmm. at the highest honor. So I started to do some research and started to look at the most state dinner had served only French food. Here was the Prime Minister of India that happened to be vegetarian and also a huge food country. And I started to think about the White House more as a home. Well, if you're going to have a dinner party with a guest of honor, you have to serve a vegetarian option. If you're going to have a lot of people over and they don't know each other, you should break bread. I started to read about Michelle Obama's initiative in terms of the garden, which is a wonderful initiative. So I felt like it has to be salad, of course, it has to be something as humble as that in there, that is of the season. So I started to craft a menu based on these pillars. And eventually there was 10 chefs and then 5 and then 2. And eventually I got asked. And again, that was a sign of specific, not generic. And also not putting myself first.
Yeah. The new book by author, chef, and restaurant owner Marcus Samuelson is called Yes, Chef, A Memoir. Marcus, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answered the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can learn more about the show and download the podcast free every day at kera.org/think. If you've got comments, questions, or suggestions, email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.